From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. Since he was elected, Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson has been trying to change the city charter to give the mayor actual executive powers, which the position currently does not have. He has brought proposals to the council twice before, only twice to be rebuffed. Now he's back with a third proposal, renamed the Checks and Balances Act of 2012, about which the city council will hear arguments tonight and may even vote on whether to put the question to voters in June. To discuss this ongoing and highly contentious issue, we have two local journalists who have been watching it closely. Melissa Corker is City Hall reporter for the Sacramento Press and has been covering this for a couple of years now. And Foon Reed is on the Sacramento Bee's editorial board and has been doing the same. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Melissa, let's start with you. How is this version of what was being called the Strong Mayor Initiative different from what we've seen before?
Well, on the one hand, it's expanded a little bit. This one includes an ethics and committee and sunshine ordinance aspect to it that previous versions didn't have. This one also calls for a redistricting commission that previous versions didn't have. But at its core, it's essentially a lot of similarities.
Mm-hmm. So, but what about specifically about the charter and the strong mayor, so-called, aspect of it? Has that been changed much? Because there were criticisms. The city attorney had some issues with it, but...
Well, one of the key things that's changed is that initially the mayor was allowed to appoint the city manager and other charter officers, the city clerk, the city attorney, et cetera. In this version, he doesn't have that power. In this version, it would just be the city manager, and then the other charter officers would still be under the purview of the city council. So that's kind of a big thing because it takes away from him where originally he would have been able to appoint department heads and a lot of city personnel would have been under his purview. In this case, that doesn't happen. He gets the city manager. So it's important, but it reduces what it was originally for him.
And so all those kinds of hiring and firing decisions remain with the city manager?
Right. They're under the manager. So he would, as he is right now, he gets to determine who the department heads are, and personnel that come and go underneath him stay underneath him. That's how this new version would keep it as well.
Okay. Funri, you've studied this. What about other cities? How does this work in other cities? Because this is a change here, but
right.
This has been done a while now.
Right. There are other cities in California that have a similar system, San Diego, Oakland, San Francisco, to name three. And, you know, I would say there's a mixed record across the state, mm-hmm. but there are, you know, so there are good points and bad points to changing the charter to go to the system. The mayor's office obviously is accentuating the positive points.
Mm-hmm. What about Los Angeles? What's the setup there?
They have a strong mayor system in a way, but there's also a commission that has some power as well, so it would be different here than in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Now we all got started calling it the Strong Mayor Initiative.
Right.
They've rebranded it as the Checks and Balances Act.
Right.
Does that make sense? I mean, does that?
Well, there, as Melissa described, it is different than the original proposal. So there are arguments for changing its name, but at its core, it would give the mayor more power, mm-hmm. and so I would say it's Strong Mayor version 3.0.
Okay. And the powers that he has that the city manager has now.
Right.
You know, some of the argument has been that this is in terms of accountability, it makes the mayor more accountable. People know they elect the mayor, and so they know who the person is who's making these decisions.
Right. And I think there's a case to be made for that. But I also think that for this to work, and just like the current system, the mayor and the city manager have to be on the same page. And
mm-hmm.
that hasn't quite been the case during the whole time Kevin Johnson's been in office. There have been several managers, as we know, that we've gone through. And, you know, they just haven't been on the same page always.
Yeah, and let me ask you about that, Melissa, because I know you're a regular attendee of city council meetings, and you've talked to everybody there. This council is known for being somewhat dysfunctional. But some of the changes in the city manager's office, how related are those to the city council or to Kevin Johnson? And how much of it is just a situational thing where we have changed a lot of city managers for different reasons?
Right. I would say you could argue that it will make a huge difference or that it might not make any difference at all. If the problem is personality. This mayor and these city managers don't get along or aren't on the same page, or these council members and this city manager or that city manager don't get along. That could change with a new group at any time. So,
which we will be getting.
Right. We have elections coming up pretty quick, and we don't really know what the council may actually end up looking like when the dust settles. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Foon is absolutely correct. The mayor and the city manager, they have to be on the same page one way or another. If at the moment the city manager has to deal with 9 different bosses, as some have said, it may be hard to get everybody all on the same page. But you could say, oh, well, if the mayor appoints the city manager, there's already going to be a congenial sense between them. There's already going to be a sense of cooperation because they already know each other. They already have good reason to work together. But at the same time, he may appoint a city manager, and then this mayor goes out, another city manager comes in, and then you've got the problems all over again.
And we should remember that Kevin Johnson did not support the current city manager, John Shirey, who came from the Redevelopment Association. And if this initiative were to get on the ballot and were to pass, Mr. Shirey has a clause in his contract where he can step down and get a pretty nice severance package out of it. So I would expect that if it does pass, that we'd have yet another new city manager who Mayor Johnson would obviously have a hand in selecting, recruiting.
That's Foon Rhee of the Sacramento Bee's editorial board, and also with me is Melissa Corker from the Sacramento Press. Foon, you mentioned that. My understanding is that John Shirey, the current city manager, has said he is not in favor of strong mayor. Is that correct?
He's indicated that. I don't think he said it as clearly as that, but I would be shocked if he stuck around if this were to change the charter.
There's something else that comes up a lot in discussing this is that Mayor Johnson, for better or worse, has been a somewhat polarizing figure. And some people really love him and some people really don't. And some of those people work with him on the city council. How much does having this in June of this year tie it to his reelection? Because they're at the same time, right, Melissa? How's that going to work? And do you think that that's going to settle some of the objections?
I think that having it at this time, rather it's June or November, it's a good thing that the mayor's office is also up for election. It gives the people an opportunity to separate the mayor from the charter revision. And rather this revision or this change is good or bad or indifferent needs to be considered separate of rather or not Johnson's going to be the guy sitting in the seat. He could be, or he might not be. The question the voters want to ask is this how we want our city to be governed? Asking it at this time when we know that there's a chance that Mayor Johnson may not still be the mayor is probably the best time to ask if you're going to ask at all.
Yeah, my understanding was that there was a piece that Sandy Sheedy, who I think has been pretty consistently anti the strong mayor, wrote a piece in 2009 saying there will be a new election. And she was against doing something in 2010 in the election. And she just wrote in the Bee, there will be a new election for mayor in 2012. Let the people of Sacramento decide then whether they want to change the city's constitution. And if so, who they want at the helm of a newly fashioned city government, unquote. Foon Rhee, do you think that's going to happen this time?
Well, that's part of the argument that the mayor's office is making, is that they're basically doing what Sandy Sheedy and other opponents back in 2009 asked for. And, you know, their argument is that the opponents keep moving the goalposts and the mayor's office keeps revising this to fit the criticisms, and that it's time to let the people vote. The mayor's office, I think, has been keeping count, and they say that tonight will be the 16th time the city council has discussed this issue. So I think for a lot of people, they just want this issue to be decided once and for all and let the voters decide this.
And do you think that do you think that some of those members who have been resistant in the past will be willing to? And again, we should emphasize this is not passing strong mayor.
Right.
This is putting an agreement to put strong mayor on the ballot in June.
Right. Possibly, but you know, the latest handicapping is that it's going to be probably a 5-4 vote one way or the other. It's looking like Councilman Daryl Fong might be the swing vote. It's possible that he and Steve Cohn will ask for some kind of term limit provision to be added to this before they would agree to make it put it on the ballot. So we'll see about that.
In fact, there have been several big endorsements of the Checks and Balances Act recently. First, former mayors Phil Eisenberg and Jimmy Yee, and just recently Ann Rudin have all come out in support to one degree or another. And yesterday, Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, who is from Sacramento and was on the city council, also came out and very clearly supported it. Melissa, do you think that those endorsements are going to carry much weight on the city council itself?
They may very well. They're pretty big players and they have big voices. If council's willing to listen to anybody's suggestion, I think that would weigh for them pretty well. But like Foon said, there's the count is not completely in, and there's still a lot of question where the council members are actually going to stand on it, especially with some of the ambiguities that are still in the proposal. They may want those addressed first, and it may not matter who speaks in favor or who speaks against if those things aren't cleared up in the mind of the council members who actually are the ones who say, yes, we want it on the ballot, or no, it's not going to go.
When you say ambiguities, what are there still remaining questions?
There are, and I want to say it's essentially designed that way. It wasn't intended, I don't believe, to be a perfect draft right out of the gate. Some of the things that the city attorney had questioned in her analysis was the Sunshine Ordinance provision and the Ethics Committee provision. It's not exactly specific who's going to be there, what's it going to do, or what is the frame of that ordinance going to be. They kind of left that open to be discussed apparently with more public input later. And things like that and term limits, again, is another thing that isn't mentioned in there, that council members individually may say, nope, I'm not sure I'm ready to go for this without those things being clarified.
And, you know, another big uncertainty is whether, if this were to pass, whether there would be a ninth council seat. Because if the mayor becomes the chief executive, you go to an 8-member council that would lead to a lot of tie votes.
A lot of deadlock, yeah.
Possibly. So that's another big decision that has to be made if this is to move forward.
You mentioned Daryl Fong before, who represents the South area. And he has been sort of unpredictable. There tend to be sort of some blocks on the city council, and he's been sort of the Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, he's gone back and forth. He has been somewhat unpredictable. On this particular issue, he has suggested that voters should get to decide big issues like this, but he also wants voters to decide on the arena issue.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting that both of these big issues are happening at the same time under long, similar timetables. There's not a whole lot of time for the council to act if they want to put this on the June ballot. Probably late February at the very latest to get this on the ballot. So if there are revisions to be made to this proposal, there's not much time at all.
And is there any move to put the arena question on the ballot?
No, I mean, that's not really on the table at this point.
Might there be some horse trading on that? Because there are council members, Sandy Sheedy, for one, who want to put the arena question on the ballot, whereas the mayor's office wants to just let's go forward.
I can't imagine that the mayor's office would horse trade on that issue because there's, again, time is of the essence on the arena issue, and there probably is not enough time to get that on the ballot in a way that the city can move forward in time.
Okay. Well, Foon Rhee of the Sacramento Bee Editorial Board, thanks for coming in. And Melissa Corker of the Sacramento Press, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, our news network looks at Stockton. Listen to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Wads Barton. When you want more information about any of our guests or topics, you can find it on our website, capradio.org/insight. And if you ever want to ask a question or comment on the show, you can do that on our Facebook page. We're Insight on Capital Public Radio. Every Tuesday, we speak with a journalist from somewhere in our listening area. And today, we're joined by Michael Fitzgerald, who is a columnist for the Stockton Record. And we want to see what's going on there. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning. And what's going on there is that Stockton, unfortunately, is California's municipal soap opera.
Sounds like, yes. The police, issues with the police.
Issues with the police. The city is so close to bankruptcy that it had to crack open a closed contract and impose cuts on the police. They sued to undo that action, and the case is in the courts right now. if the police win, the end game is really interesting in that they will demand, they can demand, would have the legal right to demand $10 million in back pay. But the city has no fiscal reserves. It's completely cored out fiscally. So the police have said, well, we don't want to bankrupt the city. And then the question is, well, how are you not going to bankrupt the city if you demand this money? Well, mm-hmm. we're just going to demand a fair deal. Well, how much is that? Mm-hmm. And how much? How will you know when enough is too much? Or you won't be actually sending the city over the edge. Well, we're going to hire an auditor. So the police's plan is to hire an auditor to figure out every nickel it can squeeze from the city, this side of bankruptcy, and then stop. But the problem is, of course, that an auditor coming from outside, a city's finances are incredibly complex and Byzantine, yeah. and Stockton's more so because there's been fiscal mismanagement and even incompetence. And so that would be a very strange era for the city, an era of enhanced police control over city finances.
And in Sacramento, we have, it's like 85%, I think, is public safety because so many other things have been cut. Is it similar in Stockton?
Yes. In Stockton, it's 80% of the general fund goes to public safety. So if you're going to have to make cuts, you have to make them out of this part of the pie. You really do. However, the unions have become somewhat used to getting their way over the years, and they're not taking no for an answer. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of mutual distrust and hostility between City Hall and the public safety unions now. The unions are justifiably, to be fair to the unions, there's been a lot of fiscal incompetence in the city of Stockton. Mm. They overbuilt a waterfront arena that is perennially losing money. As your columnist up here, Dan Walters, pointed out, it was something like $30,000 a slip. And this is in the Delta, where you just throw something out there right. and you go in your Levi cutoffs and drink cold Bud.
There's a lot of waterfront property.
Yeah, and they overbuilt a waterfront arena and waterfront marina. They're losing money on a half a dozen different redevelopment projects. The public is very skeptical, and the police just feel that it's unfair to cut them for the mistakes made by City Hall. But there's not a press in the basement that can mint money. The money has to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. So into this hostile climate comes this lawsuit, and we'll just have to see how it plays out.
And Stockton, of course, has been hit extremely hard by the mortgage, the meltdown, and so a lot of property taxes have gone way down.
Yes, a point I make when I come on this show is that although Stockton is only 45 miles down the road, it's on another planet financially. The San Joaquin Valley suffers from near Appalachian poverty. Mm-hmm. Stockton to Bakersfield, San Joaquin County to Kern County, an 8-county region. The people there make $10,000 less per capita than cities outside the region. Government collects fewer tax dollars. And then legislators up here in Sacramento tend to fly over the region. There's mm-hmm. $7 billion in deferred maintenance on Highway 99. The infrastructure is rotting out from under the valley.
$7 billion?
$7 billion of, and of course, Highway 99 is
a state highway.
The commercial Mississippi of the valley.
Uh-huh. Right.
So that's just an example of how the valley is under. I mean, California itself is a donor state. It gives more tax dollars to the U.S. Treasury than it gets back. Mm-hmm. But of those dollars that do come back, more go to the affluent coastal areas. The valley gets fewer of those dollars. So any hard times are already harder in the valley. Mm-hmm. So right now, Stockton has 10 toes over the edge of bankruptcy. And then Jerry Brown, in his wisdom, and this may have been in the interest of the state as a whole, ends redevelopment. And right. I believe you've discussed that on
yes.
your program. But I don't know if you had a representative from one of California's older cities. I mean, Stockton's a gold rush city. Its downtown is very decrepit. Mm-hmm. And there is currently no mechanism to get, I mean, with the death of redevelopment, mm-hmm. there's no mechanism for restoring this crummy downtown.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Michael Fitzgerald, who's a columnist in Stockton, at the Stockton Record. There's some of the things, just to stay with redevelopment a little bit longer. The city owes $12 million in redevelopment debt. That means that's money that was set aside that was going to be spent or has already been spent, and now they have to come back with it to give back to the state?
No. During the boom, Stockton was making maybe $25 million a year in tax increment in their redevelopment districts because 40% of the city is in a redevelopment district in Stockton. Uh-huh. 40% of the city, by definition, is blighted. Jerry Brown would say, no, you were gaming the system. You put too much of your city in the redevelopment district, and that's the sort of abuse we had to curtail. I think an argument could be made on either side. When this bust came, the a tax increment income from that the city could keep dropped by about 50%. So right now there's about $100,000 a year more than the 12 point something million dollar debt that the city's got to pay every year. So in other words, if the city's redevelopment agency were a commercial airliner, it would be flying 11 feet off the ground.
Okay.
And to top it off, the law that closes redevelopment agencies says that redevelopment agencies have to sell off their assets. So
right.
I'm convinced Stockton never saw this coming. Stockton's redevelopment assets include the Bob Hope Theater, which is a former movie show palace that the city sank millions into in the hopes that it would become a downtown arts center and mm-hmm. bring people downtown.
Kind of like the Crest in Sacramento.
Yes, exactly. It's a beautiful building.
Beautiful theater. I saw Pavement there. They were,
yes, yeah, I was there that night. I saw Pavement as well. Wasn't that a great show?
Yeah.
Children's Museum of Stockton, mm-hmm. the B&M building, which is right in the middle of Janet Leigh Plaza in the downtown redevelopment beachhead, and the city had plans for that building, blank waterfront land that the city hopes to see housing built on, DeCarli Plaza. The city is supposed to sell a plaza, a municipal plaza, and finally, the southern half of Weber Park. If you've ever been to the Stockton Asparagus Festival, it takes place on Weber Point, which is a park mm-hmm. that sort of sticks out into the delta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the city of Stockton owns the northern, if you drew an east-west line, owns the northern half, but the redevelopment agency owns the southern half. Now these and scores of blank, vacant lots mm-hmm. are supposed to be liquidated. And no sweetheart deals. As they're scrambling to understand this better because there is a loophole that says government buildings can be conveyed back to government. But that appears to be saying that if it's a city office building, the city gets first dibs on buying it, but buying it at best market value.
And the city's not buying anything.
The city has no money. So the question is, how is this going to play out? So a couple people in City Hall have told me, they won't say it on the record, but that they're going to try to toxify some of their assets. That is, they're going to try to find all the encumbrances on the deeds, mm-hmm. all the contamination in the ground, and all the reasons why this wouldn't be a good idea to buy. So it's sort of like the porcupine defense or the skunk defense for municipal properties. And we're in a completely novel, we're in terra incognita for California cities.
Mm-hmm. And the value of that property has dropped precipitously. I mean, even the best of places, a lot of these have dropped 40%, 30%, 40%, 50%.
Yes. Property in Stockton has dropped up to 65%. And the grim news is that the city fiscal gurus believe that property values are going to continue to decline. I don't know if property values here have stabilized, but they think Stockton is going to continue to lose ground until about the middle of the year. Then UOP's Business Forecasting Center says they expect a modest recovery to begin. The problem is that cities usually lag about a year behind the economy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you can look for an acute four-alarm fiscal fire in Stockton throughout 2012.
Wow. And beyond.
Well, we're hoping that things start to look up in 2013 and that there is a modest recovery of the housing industry and some housing starts. That's the forecast anyway. I hope it's right.
I'm speaking with Michael Fitzgerald from the Stockton Record. There have been some solutions that have been proposed. There's things like balancing the suburban growth on the outside with trying to force more growth into the center. And there's also talk of municipal disincorporation.
Yes. Well, it's more than a proposal to balance growth. Stockton had an absurdly sprawlish General Plan 2035, a blueprint for growth through 2035, and the Sierra Club sued to stop it. And Jerry Brown, who was then the Attorney General, said, you know what, I support the Sierra Club suit, and I'm going to join it if you guys don't come back to the table and moderate this sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
So the city did reach what's called the General Plan Settlement Agreement, and they have agreed that growth on the fringes, and Stockton is historically one of the fastest growing cities in the state, has to be balanced with infill. So that at least is one mechanism by which there's a statutory requirement for there to be some growth downtown, some action downtown, some infill within the existing city limits and not just sprawl. The question is, who's going to do it? You know, mm-hmm. Stockton has suburban developers. There are no urban redevelopers in Stockton. Urban redevelopment is extremely complicated. I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
Suburban redevelopment is so much easier. You do all your arguing up front. You get your entitlements. You build your subdivision. In downtown Stockton, which goes back to the gold rush, which was militarized during World War II, you can find Native American villages. There's one on the South Bank called Wana. You can find Chinese settlements. You find a Chinese teacup, and then, you know, the archaeological laws kick in.
Right.
When they were building minesweepers and other vessels for World War II, they were heedless of the contaminants they were putting into the ground. There's all these toxic issues. The specialty of redevelopment was to deal with that on behalf of the private sector, to aggregate the land, to get it all under one ownership, and to get rid of the contaminants through the Polanco Act or whatever, and then to say, okay, now you could make a buck here, private sector. That mechanism is now gone.
Well, it sounds like a lousy time to be working for Stockton City government and a great time to be a columnist.
I never lack for material.
Michael Fitzgerald from the Stockton Record, thanks so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, details on the changes you are about to hear on Capital Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news with our senior editor, Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what's going on?
Well, good morning. If you have a Sacramento Public Library card, you now have a chance to figure out how much your home appliances are costing you, and you can find out for free. It's a program called Kilowatt Easy Power Monitor. SMUD has donated 56 of these things to the libraries around the city. The monitor is simple to use. You plug the device into an electrical outlet, then you plug the appliance into the device. You plug in a little bit of information about how much the cost is per kilowatt hour, and it tells you how much your 120 or 220-volt appliance, say your refrigerator, your freezer, your television, your computer, is actually using and how much it's costing you. Steve Milne will have that story this afternoon. Mm-hmm. Big story of this day, of course, the South Carolina primary. The big debate yesterday, Mitt Romney kind of stumbled a little bit, but the numbers still show him in pretty good shape. Those stories and much more coming up beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
Starting tonight at 7 o'clock, Capital Public Radio's schedule will be realigned to expand news programming on this station, while the evening's Excellence of Jazz will be moved to our music station, where it will be heard from 7 to 11 p.m. Monday through Friday. Why is this change being made, and what does it mean for the future of music on Capital Public Radio? Here to explain is Rick Etchison, who is President and General Manager of Capital Public Radio. Rick, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, David.
Nice to have you on the show.
Thanks.
So what is the essence of this change? What's the big change?
Well, for a number of years, we've been doing perceptual research with all of our listeners and trying to get more feedback about what they want more, what they want less from us. And increasingly, the demand has been for more news and information. And it's difficult because we've only got two stations and we've only got so many hours of airtime to devote to each of the services that we provide. But it has been very apparent that the news audience continues to grow. And they've been increasingly frustrated at times when there's been major breaking news, when they tune to us and we're playing music. This has happened both in evenings and on weekends. And for some strange reason, a lot of breaking news has been happening at hours when we have not been providing news and information. We've been in music broadcasting. So it's really in response to the requests from the majority of our audience that we provide more news and information. So beginning this evening, we'll be adding several new shows that that have the opportunity to add newscasts as well as our news and information programs. Uh-huh. It's difficult to put newscasts into music programming because the music fans consider some of the newscasts as interruptions. So we in the past have not had news during jazz programming, for example. Beginning this evening, we will have newscasts in the evening. We'll also have newscasts on the weekend. Even in some of the music programs that we have on the weekend, we're going to be increasing the number of newscasts that we have. We're beefing up our news staffing. We'll be adding news staffing for evenings and on weekends, covering additional beats. And it's also an opportunity to add a lot of really interesting new shows that are not currently on the air in Sacramento.
Yeah.
A lot of weekend programming that I think people are really going to enjoy. One of the most popular weekend programs on public radio has not been played in Sacramento, called On the Media. We're looking forward to that. Another program that we all seem to like called Splendid Table, which will be on starting on Sundays. So that's the gist of it. Is it's an opportunity to expand our news and information service that we provide. At the same time that the tastes are changing and the way people consume music on the radio, and the internet has really made a really significant impact, and the change is actually accelerating. More and more people are consuming internet over or music over the internet
and satellite as well. I think.
Satellite as well, but satellite not so much as the internet. With the advent of all of the new appliances, the smartphones, the tablets. In-dash internet accessible audio has really changed the way a lot of people consume music. It's having an impact on all music radio, commercial and public radio. So on the one hand, it's a challenge for us because the listenership has been slowly declining on terrestrial radio for music. On the other hand, it's an opportunity. Now we can provide a 24-hour stream, like we've recently done with jazz. We have a 24-hour audio stream that plays the type of traditional jazz that KXJZ has been known for many, many years. So 24 hours a day, if you've got a smartphone app or a tablet app or access to the internet from any kind of appliance, you can hear our type of jazz curated by our announcers 24 hours a day. We're also launching now a 24-hour-a-day classical stream, which the same thing. Our announcers will be curating the music. You'll be able to, if you've got internet access from any of those appliances, be able to listen to classical 24 hours a day, even during those hours in the evening when over the radio we'll be playing jazz. On the jazz or the classical stream, you'll be able to access classical 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And as you know, there's been some grumbling about this, which I'm sure you anticipated. There's been grumbling from the jazz people about being moved off of this frequency, and there's been some grumbling from the classical people for having jazz infringe on what they're doing. And what you're describing on the web is an alternative to that. How are you doing that in terms of programming the other FM frequency so that those two don't step on each other? How does that work?
Well, one of the things that we've done is carefully select the playlist on the jazz programming that will be airing on KXPR to really reflect those classical elements that many of the jazz performers were trained in. I mean, Wynton Marsalis and Dave Brubeck, those people are classically trained. And you listen to that type of jazz that they play, and there's a lot of classical elements in it. So we are trying to be cognizant of its compatibility, but in the end, it's all great music, and it's great music that's not available anywhere else. As far as the terrestrial signal of KXPR, we are in the process of upgrading that. We finalized the lease on a new tower site. We'll be moving the tower for KXPR. Hopefully it'll happen within the next year. There's a lot of hoops we have to jump through. But when that's completed, that signal will be equivalent to or superior to the signal we currently have on KXJZ.
Oh, okay.
So the 88.9 frequency is going to be significantly upgraded within the next year or so. It's a very expensive proposition, but it's one that's well underway.
And moving back to the news side of things, since that's going to be the whole deal on this frequency, I don't think a lot of people realize what KXJZ's position in the market is here, because non-commercial stations for the longest time were not recorded with commercial stations. But this is actually on the verge of becoming the biggest station in the market. How is that going to work?
Well, we're certainly very competitive on the news and information side. Our ratings are very competitive with the commercial news stations. In the mornings, for example, during Morning Edition, it's a virtual tie between us and the big commercial news station in the market. And our audience is growing very rapidly. And if the trends continue, yeah, you would expect that we should probably overtake them in the not-too-distant future as the most listened-to news station on the radio.
And to that end, as you said, you're going to have some new reporters, new beats, and also some of the new shows. Tell us a little bit. There's the we're actually going to speak to them on Insight, but Tavis Smiley and Cornel West have a show, and this is already a show that's ongoing that we just haven't had here before.
Right. We just haven't had the hours to carry shows like that. It's a fun show. It's very different from what you've heard on Capital Public Radio traditionally. Tavis Smiley has been on our air before when he was the original host of News and Notes. Mm-hmm. And Cornel West has a Sacramento connection. He's a native Sacramento, and a lot of people know Cornel. And it's a very interesting show, and I'll be interested to hear how people react to it.
Yeah. And then there's some other shows. What else is that? You mentioned On the Media, which is usually runs on the weekends.
Yes,
right?
That's a weekend show. Tonight we'll debut a show called Q, which is from the CBC, from the Canadian Broadcasting Company. And it's a show somewhat akin to Fresh Air. It's a lot of pop culture and interviews, but there's also an attitude and a very engaging young host that I think people are really, really going to like. I'm really excited about starting that show.
And those will debut this...
Tonight.
Okay. Yeah, and we should also mention that this show is going to be repeated tonight. So people who are working at 10 o'clock in the morning are going to be able to listen to Inside at, 8 o'clock?
Yeah. One of the most frequent complaints we've had from listeners, and I'm going back to a research project we did in September of 2008. People then were starting to say, we would like to hear Insight, but we can't because we're at work during the day and it's on at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. And could you repeat Insight? And we've had the same thing about Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. Fresh Air is an enormously popular show that we carry in the morning. And a lot of people don't have a chance to listen to it. So they said, could you repeat Fresh Air? And some stations around the country do repeat Fresh Air. So we're finally getting to that. So.
Great. And any other changes that we should be looking for in all of this?
Well, I think that we will continue to expand the news and information programming that we do. We will continue to expand the amount of local news and information programming that we do because there's a need, and the audience is asking us to do that. So all of these moves are really in response to what we're getting from our audience. Mm-hmm. We're trying to be the best stewards of the stations that we can. And in order to do that, we have to respond to what the communities want.
And it's a very vocal, active audience as well.
It's an owner's
audience, isn't it?
My phone rings.
I should also mention that the complete schedule of all this information is online at capradio.org. And also, for some people who are wondering, I believe that Mick Martin's Blues Party is still going to be on Saturday afternoon, right?
That is staying on KXJZ, as well as Blue Dog Jam and some of the Saturday evening programs.
So there will still be some music on Capital Public Radio.
Yes,
KXJZ.
On KXJZ, yes.
All right. Well, Rick Etchison, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about that.
You bet. Thanks, David.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, classical pianist Konstantin Sukhovetsky. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Konstantin Sukhovetsky, who you hear right there, is a pop star among classical pianists, topping his good looks with sunglasses that suggest Bono more than Arthur Rubinstein. He's also branching out into acting, appearing in two films that will be released this year. But his playing is what has brought him fame and many awards, and he'll be doing that this weekend with the Auburn Symphony in two concerts. He joins us today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
You grew up in a family of artists and musicians, and what was that like? Do you remember the first art that you noticed as a kid?
I'm not even sure if I remember it because I never perceived life without it. But my grandmother was a ballerina, but mm-hmm. in her second career she became a books illustrator, and both my parents are painters. So I guess I was just immersed in all that. You know, everyone played the piano and enjoyed music and painted. And
this was in Moscow?
This was in Moscow, yeah. So I remember when I was a kid, it was before my dad and my mom had their own studios. They would, you know, work in our apartment, so we had to, like, sort of prance around the paintings and make sure we don't bump into giant oil canvases, you know, and things like that.
And then you started playing when you were...
Well, again, my bio says four because I think saying earlier is just embarrassing, but I don't remember not playing the piano.
Really? And was it just something that you took to, or was it sort of, well, Constantine's going to play piano because we're all artists and he needs to be doing something?
Well, you know, the myth has it that I really gravitated towards it. My parents wanted me to be a painter. I have a younger sister who is a painter. She really had no choice. So but she's a wonderful painter. I'm joking. But I suppose I was exposed to music and I really, you know, really loved doing it from early age because I was kind of, the expectation was that I was going to follow my parents.
And it didn't feel like pressure or
No child wants to practice hours a day.
Right.
So there were moments of pressure for sure. And I didn't feel pressure to be a musician. I always loved being on stage and performing before live audiences. Mm-hmm. One of my first performances that I vaguely remember, actually it wasn't even piano. I was reading some poetry at a New Year's Eve thing. And I read a poem and people clapped and I liked it so much. So I repeated the poem again. And then I repeated it again. And then the Santa Claus had to take me down. So, I mean, carry me away, not take me down. It made me misunderstood. So I really always felt that immediacy of live performances to me is something I cannot imagine not doing.
Well, let's listen to a piece or two of yours. Let's start with Mettner's Forgotten Melodies.
Yes, it's a beautiful piece.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much.
I don't know that composer.
Well, Mettner is seldom performed. I'm happy to say that recently I noticed that people playing and becoming aware of him more. He was a contemporary Rachmaninoff, a wonderful Russian composer, and I'm very enamored with his music. And I always sort of make it my point to play some of the pieces that are lesser known because we all heard the amazing pieces that everybody knows, the hit parades, mm-hmm. I call them, the Moonlight Sonata and the Liszt's, Hungarian Rhapsodies.
Rachmaninoff.
And the wonderful, of course, genius music of Rachmaninoff. But some of the music enjoys all the spotlight, and some of the music that's equally beautiful just seems to slip through the fingers of time. And I think it's our duty to bring it to the audience.
Well, and I meant to ask you because I referred to your look before, and you have shoulder length hair, and right now you're wearing a black leather vest, and you have some sparkles on your shirt. And do you find that you want to is that just a natural thing to you, or are you trying to sort of bring something a little bit different to classical music?
Well, thank you. It's me 100%. What mm-hmm. you see is what you get. I always, though, grew up to be, classical musician. I always had this other life. I acted in theater in Moscow, Moscow State Theater, for 3 years. I've anchored some children's news on television. And, as you mentioned, I've completed an independent action film this year, Dishonorable Vendetta, that's coming out sometime, hopefully soon. It's in post-production. So I always thought of myself, as a showbiz person, mm-hmm. Who just happens to be a classical pianist. But I don't have to, I never worked at creating an image of a, rock star. I just sort of, more than frequently than not, I have to subdue myself into a tux when I go, when I.
That's still sort of de rigueur for performing?
Well, no, actually. I'm happy to say that I have fans appreciating my look and my fashion style, which actually changes all the time. I don't take any of it too seriously. I mm-hmm. think it's important to have fun with these things. And last time I was here in Auburn, I had a short platinum hair, and now it's long. And So I'm going to wear a beautiful Jean-Paul Gaultier jacket with a T-shirt to play Mozart.
Nice. Speaking with Konstantin Sukhovetsky, who is going to be performing in a, what'd you say, a T-shirt and a...
And a Jean-Paul Gaultier jacket.
Jean-Paul Gaultier jacket in Auburn this weekend. Let's listen to, we have, I think, time for one more piece. This is Rockberg's Blues from Carnival Music Suite, and this is something that sort of shows a little different side of your
playing. Absolutely.
Is that a shift for you? Because I know I've known classical pianists who went on to try to learn how to play blues piano, and they could not do it.
Well, it's an entirely different set of skills. This piece, actually, I always smile when I hear it because it was composed for my teacher, a great American pianist, Jerome Lowenthal, by George Rockberg in 1972, I think, which is 10 years before I was born. So it's a special sentimental connection to that piece because he, Jerome Lowenthal, recommended that I learn it when I said to him I wanted to play something bluesy and jazzy because I actually love jazz and I took jazz improvisation for about 3 years in Moscow and a little bit at Juilliard, but then my career already started happening and I wasn't able to attend regularly jazz improv at Juilliard, so I got kicked out of the Juilliard, not of the Juilliard, of the class,
of
the jazz improvisation class. And then I asked, you know, my teacher, I said, you know, is there anything I can play that's, you know, remotely jazzy? And he said, yeah, sure, that you should learn Carnival Music Suite because it has this blues. And it sounds like I'm making it up, but it's all, you know, very actually hard to learn. It's notated very precisely, but it has to sound like I'm just sitting there jamming.
Right, so it sounds like, yeah, I mean, it's a classical composer basically, or at least a well-educated composer creating something that's not classical music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a pure blues, really. But Rockberg was, you know, classically trained composer, an American, obviously, who understood the idiom very well. And I part of it, actually, playing jazz well is you have to forget about the tone. You know, as a classical pianist, we spent decades creating the beautifully mellow sound. Mm-hmm. You know, Rubinstein was famous for it, the kind of milky, gorgeous sound, which doesn't work if you play jazz or pop music like this. It just sounds like classical music musician, you know, misunderstanding the idiom of jazz. So in jazz, it's much more percussive and it's about accents and timing rather than tone production. Once you get that in your system, I think you can really do it well.
And do you, one of the things also that I find is hard for classical music pianists particularly is jamming, which is, you know, improvisation is crucial to jazz. Where do you sit in there? Do you sit around and jam? Do you play with other people? Do you play by yourself?
Yeah, I actually do. Well, there again, you know, my yet another life in Moscow was that I was a double major in composition for about 10 years. And part of the compositional training was improvisation. I had to, every week my composition lesson began with my teacher giving me a subject, be it, you know, a little Bartok piece or Bach or something really sometimes very simple, and I would have to improvise on it, you know, for 5 minutes, and then we would go on to actually have a lesson. So I've learned improvisation very early on that way, and it's a lot of fun, especially to do with other people. So I have lots of friends who are Broadway musicians and you know, performers of different genres, and yes, we do get together and we jam sometimes. And when I'm in the South and I go out drinking at some wonderful jazz bar or something, after a second martini, I just might end up on stage. I've been known to do that. Yeah,
fantastic. Well, Konstantin Sukhovetsky will be on stage in Auburn this weekend with the symphony up there. Good luck with that show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be beautiful Mozart and an amazing Bruckner symphony.
Thanks for coming in. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight will be off tomorrow. Instead, Capital Public Radio News will provide complete coverage of Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State address. Coverage will be anchored by our Capital Bureau Chief, Marianne Russ, beginning at 10 tomorrow. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producer was Sarah Jung. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.